Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Right. Without sounding too much like an episode of The Simpsons, you'll probably know our guest this week from, you may know him from this extraordinary trailblazing compilation, which actually invented the concept of retro in 1972. You may also know him from his many years as a guitar player with Patti Smith. But most recently, you can know him again via a new book called Lightning Striking, 10 Transformative Moments in Rock and Roll. Would you please welcome, if there was only an audience, Lenny Kay.
Lenny Kay. Deafening applause.
Thank you. Welcome.
Great to see you. Very really good. You're on the promotional. You're in London, aren't you? On the promotional trail.
I am
trail.
In London. Yes.
Well, look, the book is 10 Transformative Moments in Rock and Roll. Give us some idea of the basic premise. I mean, it's particular moments in time and place that had a kind of changed the landscape, really, isn't it?
That's pretty much it. Those locuses of energy and that seem to create a sea change. And it's kind of an evolutionary history of rock and roll. I mean, of course, it leaves out this and that and the other thing. But when I look at the archaeological layers of the music that I celebrate there, I kind of looked at where things kind of shifted. The universe shifted and all of a sudden... It evolved. There was a new style, a new way of looking at the music that seemed to render whatever happened before somewhat old-fashioned and pointed the way to the future.
Okay, but look,
we're gonna go for three particular areas. We thought
we picked three. Yeah, it's just three. A random.
And the first one was the chapter in because it's just so interesting to hear your view of it as an outsider. But it's 1962. You talk about Liverpool. And you talk about England, and obviously, you know, all the stuff, none of that stuff that happened before the Beatles would have been apparent in America, particularly somebody your age, you know. And sure. So what was your reaction when you found out about, you know, the stories of people like Larry Parnes and his stable, Tommy Steele and Johnny Gentle? Like, did it seem cartoonish and incredibly derivative of American rock and roll, which it was?
I felt charming in a weird way. I mean... I actually love pre-Beatles English rock and roll. There's some aspect of the wannabe in it. There's some aspect of looking at themselves in a mirror and trying to be what this weird American music that's kind of filtrating into Britain. And it's looking for identity. And to me, that's pretty much what these musical scenes are about. They're looking to form an identity and they don't quite know what it is. And I especially like Liverpool in 62 because you have a kind of scene that's very removed from anything. I mean, Liverpool is up in the north, you know, it's not in the music business center. So it has a lot of time to kind of incubate and stir its components. And it has a club to do that in and a distinctive sound. And it's somewhat apart until it bursts upon the world. And, you know, for me as a young teenager in America, I do remember the impact that the Beatles had on myself as a true fan of music, I guess, and how immediate was that impact and how it rendered everything before that before. And, you know, suddenly the channel was changed. And I, at the wonderful age of 17, just 17, do you know what I mean? You know, I was primed in the sweet spot to think, wow, I'd like to do that. I know three chords. I'm going to try to have a band, whatever.
So were you one of that generation? Like
I was totally.
John Fogerty, I mean, or whatever.
I'd learned my first guitar chords a few months previously. I wanted to be a lonely folk singer in the backyard. But when the Beatles came, it was a whole it wasn't even so much what they were playing, but it was a whole new breed of band, you know. Previous, yeah, the bands in my hometown in New Jersey were kind of instrumental, like the Ventures, you know, Johnny and the Hurricanes, playing, you know, dance. And we were so in the Northeast that it wasn't like I had rockabilly bands to emulate or anything like that. I did want to be a second tenor in a doo-wop singing group for a while, but you know, as soon as I started, my voice got kind of changed. Then all of a sudden I had the Beatles, and you know, they were a band. They all sang. It wasn't like even a lead singer in front and some anonymous backing musician. So there was the model, and I was certainly not alone. There were thousands of wannabe hope for musicians in America who got swept up in what the English invasion was about. And so by the end of 1964, I was in my first band, the Vandals.
The Vandals, is that the name?
Vandals, bringing down the house with your kind of music. We played mostly fraternity houses on college campuses, where our big moment was playing Shout for 20 minutes. And so the brothers could swim in beer on the floor. It was a great learning. I was actually trained in college for what I've now become, which, you know, I was a student of American cultural studies and you know, minored in having a rock band. And gee, I'm still doing both. It's amazing.
the extraordinary thing about the Beatles in America is it's happened so suddenly, didn't they? Because they kind of came in at the top. They didn't slowly work their way up. Do you think we'll ever see anything quite as dramatically quick ever again? Or was there ever anything quite
as quick? Well, you know, we did see Nirvana, so, you know, suddenly. I mean, there was a lot of paving of the way, and they had a whole different cultural landscape. But, you know, sometimes when these things, I mean, what about Elvis? When Elvis came along, suddenly everything before Elvis changed. You can see how these sea changes operate. It's a whole different performance style and kind of, you know, it's like a meteor hits a certain era of music and wipes out all the dinosaurs, and then you have a whole new mutation coming up. And I it's how I chart history. You know, I mean, if you know, you can look at the you know, it's like the Jurassic period, the Precambrian, you know, the Mesozoic. The different cities and times and places, I didn't have to hunt for them. They were there. There are a couple of places I wish I could have visited, but I had to make sure I finished the book somewhere within my lifetime. It just kind of grew like Topsy. I would have liked to have gone to Manchester perhaps in the mid-90s and participated in the factory and the Happy Mondays and stay out all night in the Hacienda taking drugs, which I didn't get to do. But
can I ask you about one person you mentioned in the chat, which is Joe Meek? It's really interesting. You go on a little pilgrimage up to his place in Holloway Road. Why was he so significant for you? And was there an American equivalent, really?
Well, the American equivalent would be Phil Spector, I would say. People who were so maniac about sound and utilized the performers as components in their soundscape. Joe Meek, I mean, first of all, I'm attracted to eccentric, slightly mad characters.
Yeah.
I mean, he was certainly a strange one, but also he helped lay the foundation for kind of breaking the British recording industry into the future. You know, as we know, it used to be, you know, engineers in white coats, and, you know, you can't really get into the red zone. That's so horrible. And you don't really want to hear the bass drum because it's, you know, it disturbs whatever. You know, he really brought English recording into its present tense in early 1960. And I just, you know, he seems like a character that kind of bridged this very saccharine teen idol thing, and all of a sudden brought, even though his performers were teen idols, they, you know, he brought their surroundings into the future. I mean, I really think that he was important in making things sound like they were pushing against the speakers, something very important for rock and roll.
Yeah. let's move forward. So that's 62, 63. Let's zoom
like
through.
H.G. Wells. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, yes, wavy lines. This is a movie. There'll be wavy lines. There'll be a calendar flicking past. That's right.
So let's move to 1975. New
a good
York.
Year. I seem to remember that year.
Which you were very definitely at the center of and a participant in.
Amazing, right?
Tell us what you wrote about that, what you remember about that.
Well, I remember more than perhaps I should, but it was amazing. You know, I was so influenced by the San Francisco scene, not only for the music and the thing, but the fact that it was like a beacon. When I had the Fillmore poster on my wall in New Jersey of New Year's Eve from 1966 into 67 with the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, I realized that this was kind of a cauldron of imagination. And I longed to be there. And, you know, of course, in 1967, I got into a 56 Ford with my buddy Larry.
Yes, you drove to the Lovin', didn't you? That's right.
Yeah, we just did. Just kept each state had a new drug. And by the time we reached San Francisco, you know, it was everything I'd hoped. It was really a mecca for a new sound. And at that point, of course, the new sound was on its way to becoming the cliche and the stereotype that all of these scenes actually become and become ready for the next transformation. But one day in 75, I'm standing outside of CBGB, probably with Richard Lloyd, gazing at the, the bums lying on the corner and, you know, dodging the bottles being thrown at us from the flop house upstairs. And I start thinking, wait a second, this combination of bands, there seems to be an energy locus here. And, you know, that's about the time when it's starting to get picked up by the British papers. That people are starting to recognize something's happening. But those 2 years before, when it was just the local bands playing for each other in probably the only rock club in town, that's when it all kind of congealed. It was, you know, it kind of came together like this, space gas forms into an actual solar system.
So did New York have a characteristic that all those groups, did they all have something in common that was
what
to
they
do
had
with the
in
place?
Common? And this is what makes it
this
special.
This is Ramones, Patti Smith, Talking Heads, etc. Yeah.
Yeah. What they had was a sensibility. All the groups were really different from each other. Tom Verlaine, in a great quote, says each group was like a different idea. But the sensibility was kind of oriented on this concept of punk, which didn't really have a style except for what would be the Ramones. It was just kind of an attitude more than anything. It was an umbrella for a sense of otherness, you know, that you were not part of this massive superstructure. Even if you're in one of the music capitals, you're really subterranean. And, as the word punk became more known and then, of course, imported to England, where it achieved a very specific fashion style, musical style, and it was very hard to break out of that. A lot of great records, let's be honest. But to me, when musics figure themselves out so well that they can be defined, that's when it's time to move on. I like those moments when nobody really knows what's happening. It's like Nuggets. I mean, those bands were dealing with a lot of artistic possibilities that were suddenly open to rock and roll bands. They didn't have to be just teen. They could aspire to whatever. And over the 60s, of course, they aspired so much that a room was made for a whole new crop of bands to kind of figure themselves out and move in the opposite direction. If everything was 10-minute songs, you know, the Ramones will take it back to a minute and a half and, you know, play seven songs in that 10 minutes. It's a very reactive process. And I like that. I like change. Once something gets figured out, you know, hey, let's move it on into the future.
it's interesting. You touched on it there, and with punk particularly, it was kind of, it was a British emulation of an American idea that it kind of went back and forth, didn't it? Very, very quickly at that point.
Well, you know, same with when the English invasion happened in America. America took it and made it what we know now call the garage band. You know, they wanted, you know, most of the American bands, you know, either did them or the Kinks or the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. You know, they had some elements of all these groups, but they started spinning it, and then it really spun into its own thing, whatever that thing is. And, you know, sometimes it's better not to specify what it is, but, you know, garage bands became a thing. You had your yowling lead singer, you had your reedy farfisa type organ, you had your fuzz tone guitars, you had the singer's attitude of, you know, let me get my, and that kind of got underground when things became progressive. I love progressive rock. I like all rock. I mean, really, just got to find the good ones. But to be honest, it's like then things got really larger than life. And so it's time to bring it down. And so the punk bands derived a lot of inspiration from the garage bands and melded it with this kind of spirit that was happening at CBGB. And so we have the great punk explosion of London in 1977. You know, it's kind of a ping pong. I mean, I learned about Muddy Waters, not from buying his Chess records. I learned, you know, Muddy Waters song from the Rolling Stones. And then who is this Muddy Waters? And then, you know, it's like sometimes you see things differently when you look in the mirror. I'll be your mirror. Reflect what you are in case you don't know. And, you know, I think this kind of give and take between two basically English language countries. So it's easy to meld the two. It's a continuous exchange of, may I say, bodily fluids. It's, you know,
say what you like,
but it kind of interacts. And, I'm always because I like when things blend. I'm not a big fan of definitions. There's an album by the Red Crayola, which I'm sure you have up in that pile of albums behind you. And on the back of it, Mayo Thompson says, definitions define limit. And especially with Patty, we've always believed that. We don't belong to any musical camp. In CBGBs, we were as much hippies as we were punks, as who knows what the heck we are. But, you know, this is the way you give yourself room to evolve, grow, and have a long lifeline. I have no desire to be a part of, you know, punk hits of the 70s or whatever, you know.
So amazing description of the unsigned bands festival in 1975, you know, Blondie and Talking Heads and Ramones and stuff. I just wonder if there was any groups there at the time that you thought didn't achieve that kind of level of success and deserve to do a bit better.
I always had affection for the Shirts. I think Annie Golden was a really great singer, and their songs were very complex. They didn't really belong to anything. I have some affection for the Miamis, who to me had the catchiest song, "We Deliver 24 Hours a Day." I can still sing it. But by then the cream was starting to be skimmed, and, you know, we know the usual names, and most of them got record contracts, and, you know, got to have their shot in the world. Mink DeVille, I think Mink DeVille was actually on that Unsigned Bands Festival. And
they were.
They had their own thing, which really had nothing to do with, quote, punk, unquote.
No, it's true.
But on the other hand, you know, punk was still being defined even then. They were unsigned bands. It wasn't like, you know, the neo-punk festival. I think punk, when I realized punk was like a very specific type of thing, was when the Dead Boys moved to CBGB from Cleveland. And and they were great. I mean, Steve Bader's was crazy. And he once wrapped his microphone cord around his neck so tightly that he passed out on stage. You know, gotta love that commitment.
It's the extra mile, isn't it?
Oh, so, yeah, totally.
Let's move to the third scene that we've selected out of your 10 in the book, which is Seattle. And again, there's a similar kind of, because I think Kurt Cobain used to describe Nirvana as a punk group, didn't he? That he was very influenced by the Sex Pistols from pretty near 20 years earlier. Sex Pistols,
Black Flag. I mean, you know, I think that was one of the reasons why he took so badly to becoming such a phenomenon. It was a hit band. That was a phenomenon. And, you know, it's almost like his whole thing after they made that classic first record was trying to find a way out. But also the rock and roll lifestyle is quite an enticement, and you have to be very brave to kind of rebel against it. He partook in the drugs part of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You have to be aware, you know, I mean, with Patty, we've survived for a half century because really our focus is in the work. I've stayed out many a night dancing to White Wedding at 3:30, and I hope to sometime again this week. But the thing is that really, we're about the work. We're about progression. We don't want to write songs that are our old songs sideways. We just don't make albums for the sake of making albums. It's when we have something to say, either to ourselves or to the universe. We're about work. And I know that, especially in the metal chapter with the hair metal, this is like a music that's kind of catchy, you must say, but it's also built on appreciation of the delights that are offered on a silver platter to rock stars, and often you forget why you're playing music in the first place. And makes for great tales. The metal chapter is actually one of my favorites, especially the Norwegian one, which you got to think that's about as crazy as it gets.
That is extraordinary, because there's Norway with the highest kind of employment rates in the world, you know, and enormous amounts of peace and prosperity. And of course, inevitably, it produces a musical genre which is about burning down churches and all manner of
insane. But as I keep reminding myself, the guy from Mayhem who was knifed to death by his bass player, you know, what did he do? He owned a record shop. He was a guy who appreciated all those albums. You know, he just wishes there was a Voivod album under V's over there in the lower right-hand corner. But, you know, they were music fans. It's just that sometimes you believe your own myths too much. And to me, that's the danger. You have to realize that you're not becoming the music. You are using the music to get outside yourself. You know, whatever conflictions and dissonances and weird emotions that you have to deal with, you know, that's why music and art was invented, to take it outside yourself so it doesn't kill you. And in both of those metal scenes, you know, and I like to bang my head as much as the next human, they believed in their myth more than the healing power of their music. But it makes for a great story. It's really, I chuckled so much as I was reading it, and thank God I wasn't living it.
So your book is about 10 things that took place in particular places, in particular right. times. Now we're obviously nowadays in the world of social media. Do you think you'll have those kind of scenes again in the future, geographically located?
Because you can't imagine that there'll ever be local music scenes, because
because the local music scenes need time. All of these scenes had a couple of years to understand themselves without outside influence. Surely Seattle, surely New York, as I said, you know, that's what underground is about. Now, especially with the ease of everyone, you know, a band will do its first gig and then, you know, it'll be putting it all up on social media. So not only is it somewhat more self-conscious, but it's also like too soon. You need to toil away in obscurity for a while to understand who you are. I mean, it took the Patti Smith Group, 3 years to add a drummer. We weren't like all of a sudden, this is what we do. You need that time to make your mistakes, to understand who you are, and to gather about you. These scenes are not just the bands, as Brian Eno's descriptive is, they're about scenius. It's not individual genius.
Yeah.
It's about, the people in the audience, the cultural moment. Would the Sex Pistols have been the Sex Pistols without the Bromley contingent, those people around them reflecting the music and creating a whole interplay? He calls it an ecology, and I really like that, of there's curiosity seekers, there's people coming down thinking, man, I'm going to make a fortune out of this. There's the bands, there's the people dressing, so the bands want to dress like those people. It's a great little, what do they call it? Stew pot is, anyway, when you stir the whole
melting pot.
I mean, and I like that. And sometimes they have to exist on their own. My suspicion, because the book ends really pre-email, 1993. I don't think I got my first email until maybe 90, somewhere in that year, maybe 93. And I said, well, I'm getting something over the computer. Dial it up. But of course, now the computer is everything. If you don't have a phone to get your QR code, you're done. So it's like, technology has its own momentum. And I believe that probably the next scene will be these little pockets of the web where like-minded people gather and understand each other. It'll be kind of like cyber geography, I guess. And I don't know, I probably won't be participating in it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because so many, it's just so interesting because so many of the things that you write about in here are about people physically meeting, aren't they? You know what I mean? They bump into each other and they recognize something about each other. And
people hanging out. I mean, that's to me, that's how it goes. I mean, we can be talking, over a computer or whatever, but it's not like you and me sitting at the bar shooting the breeze. I mean, I spent as much time at CBGB standing outside, talking to my friends, Seymour Stein, whatever it is. Then I'd walk in and the Ramones would be fighting on stage and I'd walk at it, because I know they'd be back. I mean, people always say to me, with a sense of wonder, what was it like? And they're always a little disappointed when I say, it was just another night at the local. You probably have one too in Peoria, Illinois, except we had some bands that gathered their energies together. I mean, think about Athens, Georgia. I mean, there is a real, and I wanted to cover at one point, do a little chapter on Athens and Minneapolis.
Oh, B-52s, Pylon, R.E.M.
I mean, it's a really good scene clustered around, I think it was the Crocodile Club or I forget what the name of the club. Anyway, I thought that's a really a good example of a very insular scene that's not a major capital. These scenes don't have to be major capitals. But, if you have a bunch of people gathering and doing a bunch of stuff, that's kind of great. And I like to hang out, in New York, I really seldom go up and see, the hotshot groups up at Madison Square Garden or whatever. I mostly go to see my friends play downtown. And that time in 1975, when my friends were playing downtown, all of a sudden the lightning struck. It's funny when you think about that, it's like all of a sudden that you're where it's at. And it's kind of great. And I look on it very, with a sense of bemusement, but I also know that really when I was down there and one of the six or seven top shelf groups were on the stage, I'm sitting at the bar thinking, geez, it's a really cute girl down there. maybe if I bought her a beer, you know, I'm here in the talking. I'm not, you know, up in the front going, wow, I'm seeing something great. It's like, yeah, I'm just hanging out. And somebody comes over to me and, hey, you want to play the pinball machine? Okay, sure. So we have a little pinball excitement. It's weirdly normal. And then it moves into legend. I assume Paris in 1920s was like that. You know, I think Ernest Hemingway said something like, Paris, before it was a legend, that was that was when it was Paris.
Yes.
And, you know, so, but now they're all legendary. 10 transformative moments. Done.
There you are. There you are. All done. Lightning Striking by Lenny K. Lenny, it's been lovely to talk to you.
Really
before
great.
You go, I've got to ask you one question, because you've clearly got more records than I have, more records than everybody watching.
Don't bet on it. I'm really picky.
Okay, well, I bet you've been actually really picky for quite a long time. I want to know, how do you file them? Alphabetical? Okay.
Well, my 45s are really a mess. I have to say, I'm going to devote a week. I'm going to get some really kind bud, and I'm going to try to figure out the actual categories. My albums are not that bad. You know, the major food groups, there's a country section, a jazz section, a reggae section.
Food groups.
Yeah, there's a pop section, which kind of spills over. There's an avant-garde section. I have a really nice collection of dance 12 inches, which I indulge myself in all the time. But the section I really like is the wacko section, where you just have these records, you know, when you see them in the records, you buy them for the cover, you know, and they're just like insane people. And I bought one because I keep buying them. When I was in Amsterdam, I bought the new album by Blackwater Holy Light, which is an all-female metal band on Riding Easy, who I have quite an affection for, that label. They're the ones who do the Brown Acid series, which in my mind is the new Nuggets. But then I found, I was with Lee Brackstone, who's the editor of White Rabbit Books, and he was buying records like crazy. I said, that's my editor. He's, look at that. records. Yeah. But we're looking through the prog rock section. I don't often go there, but a krautrock. And he takes out this Hungarian group. I can't remember the name. I haven't listened to the record. They looked so nutty from 1978. And he says, oh, this is good. This is kind of like soft prog. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just take it home and put, you know, I wish I had it here to show you, but unfortunately I don't. But, you know, I that's my weird section, and it's mostly alphabetized. So especially the.
But you've got to know that something's in the wacko section. And then once you're in the wacko section, you find it alphabetically.
But I want
you know, and often, you know, you pull it out and it's kind of, you know, I have a lot of those, what are they called? Command records, which are like, you know, the train going from here to there. And or here's, we have a stereo system.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, it's just so many records in so little time.
So Captain Beefheart under C or B?
That's interesting. I probably see.
Probably C.
You know, Captain. I guess I don't think of Beefheart as his last name, and I start with that album "Safe as Milk," right on. You know, and I have original copy. Thank you. With absolutely. A sticker inside. Oh yeah.
Oh, I bet you do. I bet you do. We'd love to come round and see it, Lenny. So maybe
anytime, you know, anytime you're in Northeast Pennsylvania, I'll open my door to you. And, you know,
we'll go straight to the wacko section.
And actually, I love when people come over, because most of the time I look at the records and I think, oh, what am I going to listen to? Sometimes I do that thing where you just kind of reach into it at something.
Yeah,
and you realize, like I was thinking, why don't you do that, David? Just reach back and get a record at random and let's see what
this is bound to be something really embarrassing in front of
that's
Lenny
the best
Kay.
One.
There you go. It's the Rocksteady Crew.
Yo.
There you go.
Oh, that's
from
great.
That's the early 80s, isn't it? It's like eight.
Hip hop don't. And
that's
hip-hop
very good. That's
stop.
Very cool. It is.
It is. It is quite oddly cool, isn't it?
It is that's extremely cool. See, people wouldn't expect you to own that, Dave. That's great. And you'll be playing it tonight.
Well, I will be playing it tonight. Lenny, It's been lovely, lovely talking to you.
Really great to talk to you guys. It's wonderful. This has given me a real opportunity to hang with music fans, and it's wonderful. I was on Soho Radio this morning. We had a great chat. You know, Jason Pierce of the Spaceman 3 interviewed me yesterday. We've just been on our own trips. I love talking. I mean, that's what I like to spend my time in. You know, I go into the record store and whoever's standing next to me, you know, we start talking about records and he says, man, have you heard this? And I said, no. And you heard this. And, you know, I like the social aspect. I once wrote a song called Record Collector because when I worked at Village Oldies, all these people who really had no, they were kind of lonely people. I mean, not saying we're lonely, but, you know, they had no place, but they really liked to come into the store once a week and buy their record and talk about it. You know, I didn't know their name. So this one was Mr. Beatles or, you know, Mr. Leslie Gore. It really told me that what we are doing, we're in a social circle, you know, the record universe. And like a record, it goes round and round. I just like it. I like to go to, you know, these days I go to record flea markets and, you know, I don't really need anything. I don't even want anything, but I'll just walk around and people will turn me on to this or I'll, you know, wind up in an odd, you know, genre and I'll say, wow, I really should collect Square Dance records. Of course, then I get home and I think, what did I do?
What have I done?
Yeah. This podcast was brought to you by The Word.